Well, good morning, everybody. It's one of those rainy mornings in Washington, D.C., so I'm proud of all of you for having made it through the traffic and made it on time here. So welcome. My name is Carl Meacham. I am the director of the Americas program here at CSIS. And it truly is a great morning and a special day for our program. We have Maria Corina Machado. We have the president of Chile in the afternoon, two of my favorite people. So I'm super, super happy. I think this is going to be a timely discussion with a courageous woman and someone who I have the honor of calling my friend. So I'm really happy that she's here today. I'm going to start a little bit with a little bit of context on recent events in Venezuela, just to put it out there. I know most of you are aware of these things and keep up with this. But this, a lot of this is for the audio, because this event is repeated over and over again. You can get the link and you can send it to your friends, and it just goes out there. So recent events in Venezuela need little introduction, but it's important to remember the context of today's discussion. October 2012 saw the re-election of Hugo Chavez when he defeated his main challenger, Enrique Capriles, of the Democratic Unity Roundtable by about 11 percentage points. President Chavez was gravely ill and succumbed to cancer in early March. This set the stage for the special presidential election in April, where despite numerous electoral advantages for the incumbents, there was an extremely narrow margin between the vice president, who was President Chavez's hand-picked successor, and Enrique Capriles. The situation in Venezuela since then has remained tense, to say the least. Despite calls for a full recount owing to alleged irregularities, the current government largely sidestepped the issue, and the limited recount that was done actually showed an increase in votes for Mr. Maduro. This was an outcome that was difficult to understand for most sensible Venezuela watchers. Since April, the opposition has continued to make its case and stating that the electoral victory of Mr. Maduro was the result of fraud and that he should not be recognized as Venezuela's president. This effort has included numerous trips throughout the region to meet with regional governments. Just this week, Mr. Capriles himself met with Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos. This was last week. This quickly led the current Venezuelan government to proclaim that it was putting its bilateral relationship under review. In fact, the opposition has faced numerous harassments for its continued challenge at home and abroad of April's result. And there's nobody here that can better attest to that than our speaker today. In an attack in the Venezuelan Congress that garnered international attention, several members of the opposition found themselves mercilessly ganged up on and beat by members of the current government, including Ms. Maria Corina Machado. She is currently a representative in the Venezuelan National Assembly from the state of Miranda. Ms. Machado is also in charge of the international outreach for Mr. Capriles. Everyone should have a copy of Ms. Machado's bio in front of them, so I will not go into details of her distinguished career in the interest of time. But before we get started, I just want to go over a couple of ground rules for today's session. We are on the record and recording the audio to place on our website. After the opening session, we will have a Q&A. We will have several members of the Americas program staff passing around wireless microphones. When asking questions, please identify yourself and your affiliation. I know that this is an issue that many of you are passionate about, and I know that folks are going to want to give their opinions, which is fine, but please try to keep them brief, because in the interest of everybody's time and everybody who's come here, I want to get as many questions as we can to our distinguished guest. So I won't keep our guest waiting any longer. With that, I want to thank you all for joining, and Maria Corina, the floor is yours.
Good morning to all. Thank you to the members of CSIS and especially Carl Meacham for this opportunity. I was last here in Washington around 3.5 months ago, 7 weeks before our presidential election. And I have to say that, to say the least, I found a very skeptical audience when I spoke about the outcome of the elections. And and how much trust I had in our people. And the reactions were several, but I would say that there was no one in the room that believed there was a chance we could actually triumph and have a victory. And what we've seen, and as we see and feel, April 14th was an overwhelming victory for democracy and institutions in Venezuela. We, the people in Venezuela, a white majority, know what happened as well as you do, and we believe that the proof of how much we are willing to fight and how much we're willing to risk for the values and for the legacy we will leave to our children was proved that day. Today, I will try to address the nature of the crisis we are living in Venezuela, the outcomes, possible outcomes, but certainly most important, the strategy Venezuelan Democrats and the unity are hardly deeply working on. To understand the nature of the crisis we're living, we're going through, it's very important to understand the true and clear nature of the model, the regime that is in power in Venezuela right now. This is something we have discussed extensively, but I would like to add just a couple of elements. First, I always like to call things by their names, so I've been talking about a neo-dictatorship. It's a system that controls public powers and uses and has a democratic facade, mostly looking for legitimacy through different sources. Of course, one of them is elections. That's why we've had 20 elections in 15 years. It's not the only source of elections. International acceptance and what I usually call pseudo-legality. It's also a way to increase that legitimacy. But there are certain elements, troubling elements, that must be taken into account when we evaluate and make this characterization of the regime in Venezuela that I will mention really fast. One is the degree of militarism, exacerbated militarism, that it's throughout the state and society today. Two is the degree of intervention of the Cuban regime. It's advisory and actual presence in our institutions. Third, I would say the ties to organized crime that has penetrated institutions. And it's important to insist on this because there is an important group of individuals that are clear that they don't have a fallback position in the times to come. And finally, I would say there is a complex and wide array of, I'd say, external stakeholders that have ties to other states and which our objectives are not clear, to say the least. So I would say this is important to have in mind to now address what I've called this multidimensional crisis that is taking place in Venezuela. And I would say at least three important levels of it, or clear levels of it. One is a crisis of legitimacy. The second is the social and economic crisis. And finally, how this has turned into a governability crisis. Regarding the first, the crisis of legitimacy. This has two dimensions, legitimacy of origin and legitimacy in exercise. Regarding our first, April 14 creates a totally different scenario. If you live in Venezuela, if you visit Venezuela, you can have, and you can, as I say, feel how a society today that's part of this democratic movement is absolutely convinced that we are a majority and that those were the true results of the elections. I just saw this week the latest poll by Alfredo Keller, and citizens were actually asked if they believed that there had been fraud in the last elections. 47 said yes, 5 said probably yes, 41 said no. So it's 52 to 41. Regarding the auditing process and the whole process that CNE was committed to do, 67 agreed with that the process should have been carried out, compared to 31 that did not agree. But if there was any doubt in terms of the true results, the actions the government put in place after certainly erased those doubts. And I'm, of course, regarding to two elements that Carl Mitchin mentioned. One has to do with a total process of recount and audited, an auditing that the government had committed with the presence of UNASUR. And as we all know, it is not happening. What the CNE is doing is something very different from what they had committed and what citizens expected. The second is a reaction of the Supreme Court. Not that we are surprised, but it is evident that they, if they accept the demand to carry out this recurso and process of impugnación, the proofs that would drive us into new elections will come out. So the cost of accepting what the institutional route should be is huge for a government because they realize they would, you know, be put in evidence in terms of who is the majority in Venezuela today. So that is regarding legitimacy of origin. For a government that has based so much of its support on that idea, finding themselves in this new situation put them in a really tough position. So they decided to move forward with repression in order to get their supporters closer committed. This has brought, and I would mention only four actions that have day by day even undermine more the legitimacy of the government. That is the persecution of public employees. We've got over 4,500 denounces since the elections, people just because they suspected they had betrayed the revolution voting for Enrique Capriles. But I believe that probably the best moment where you could see the degree the government would be willing to go was a May 16 address of Nicolás Maduro in Barinas, where he actually said that he had the names and IDs of over 900,000 Venezuelan citizens that had not voted for him, actually threatening those that had betrayed the process. Of course, criminalization of protests and the way our students and women have been hurt in the streets. Third, I would mention, of course, the coup at the parliament. And that's probably something we could address at the Q&A stage. But I would say, just imagine what it would feel here in this country or in any democratic country that the people in charge of or the president of Congress says the whole opposition, majority or minority, will not have the chance to speak if they do not firmly, publicly accept any question, any examination of conscience made by the President of Congress, and willing and promoting physical force in order to make our position change. And of course, the situation in the Congress right now is not back to normality. It is not a democratic Congress, and it's something that we can, as I say, further discuss. And finally, in terms of undermining this legitimacy of exercise, we could not mention the tapes that were certainly recently disclosed that proves the degree of corruption and this moral destruction of institutions. When these tapes were analyzed, some experts talk about 17 different crimes, 13 individuals linked in that very inner circle of power today, linked to these crimes, and 15 public or institutions involved. So, and this person, Mario Silva, it's important to insist, was one of the members of Hugo Chavez's inner sanctum. I mean, it's not that it's new information, but it's the fact that it's a confession from someone that has been supported and protected and used by Hugo Chavez as probably one of his main sources of communication. I won't stop at the second economic and social crisis. I think it's obvious how scarcity of basic goods are increasing. I would just say that for the first time since 2003, for the first time, economic issues are a bigger problem than violence and insecurity in Venezuela. It's for the first time in 10 years. And it's a ratio the answer in the same poll, 47% of the citizens would say their main concern is economy, towards 37%. This is something we've not seen yet. It's troubling with things. We are seeing events such as what happened in Cabruta a couple of days ago, in which citizens start taking into their hands resolutions of violent actions. A command of the National Guard was actually fired by the people in Cabruta and Huarico. So we're starting to see this kind of reactions. And I would say something, many that things that are happening are not being reported. So I think there's a huge underestimation in terms of the social unrest in Venezuela today. So, well, of course, this turns into a governability crisis, which one of the elements that it's obvious is there is an absolute lack of trust in institutions. And the government is to blame now that they need institutions to somehow regain some legitimacy. Well, they have destroyed the credibility of those institutions. The government has furthermore taken some actions, as I say, to maintain their give the sense of power and control, which, on the other hand, have had the different effects, such as the militarization of the country. I'm talking about roughly, they've said, 12,000 militaries, members of the army in the streets. And as we know, they get fear and intimidate everyone but the actual criminals. The pressure on the media, the case of Globovisión and so on, we can also further discuss. Political persecution, what happened to what's happening to some of my colleagues at the parliament, some very, very troubling, Richard Mardo and three others, the case of Leopoldo López this same week. And finally, you know, there's a structural problem. If you have the same people with the same policies, things will not change. And that's actually the problem now. It's not a new government. It's actually the same government with the same people with the same policies. So this has created a huge problem of trust and the possibility of governability in Venezuela. So possible scenarios, many, anything could happen in Venezuela, and that's something that said it responsibly, it's very, very troubling. We can discuss as well what are all those scenarios. I would say that most of them are very dangerous. Very dangerous, involve violence, involve confrontation, and what we are certainly focused and committed is to work in one, which is the transition, the democratic transition of our country based on the will of the people and our determination to have a country in which democratic institutions are there and prevail. So what are we doing? We're working, of course, in two dimensions. One is the internal agenda, and the other is the international agenda. The internal agenda, it's clear. We are going through all the institutional steps that locally should be addressed, not being naive, totally conscious of the control of the government and the Cuban regime on these institutions, but maintaining the pressure, the people pressure, in order to raise the political cost of the government blocking this route. And of course, that requires many forms of dissent. Yes, they're nonviolent, but they have to be firm, and they have to be strong, and we have to be clear for the government and governments that Venezuelans, we are determined to live in peace and freedom. The external agenda, I would say, and of course this is an issue that I would like to discuss further at the Q&A also, is that we are certainly seeing a very different reaction from different sectors, especially in Latin America, in the last months. The reasons are clear. Not only that those countries know that the equation in Venezuela has changed, I believe the incentives are shifting towards acting and speaking out. Why we are trying to, and we're working hard, in increasing the political costs of governments, democratic governments, to ignore what's taking place in Venezuela. And we're working hard on a new line, what we call the parliamentary diplomacy. And that's something that, as probably you're aware, has been giving us really good results. We're talking today over 30 missions to different parliaments in Latin America, and the results are there. Resolutions from different congresses, the possibility to speak in something that is denied in Venezuela, something I have never been able to do in my own Congress. Imagine speaking out to the whole Senate of Colombia, and twice I've been able to do that to the whole Chamber of Representatives in Colombia. So it's quite a moving and huge honor and opportunity. In terms of next steps, I would say we're working in three lines. We need, of course, to strengthen these interparliamentary relations in order to have this political internal cost raise, increase for specific and priority countries. Second, the whole Inter-American system and the OAS, which we believe needs to be shaken by not only certain groups, but I would say certain countries that have ignored actually how much it would suffer as a system if it not acts immediately in Venezuela. I mean, it is not only Venezuela who's violating the Inter-American Democratic Chamber. Every single state that is a part of that chamber, that signed it, is violated it if it doesn't react to what is going on in Venezuela today, because there are commitments there to defend institutions. And I believe it is time that democratic countries make it clear that they will not tolerate further destruction of democratic institutions in our region. And third, I won't discuss it in detail, but I believe, since you have President Piñera this afternoon, I hope you ask him regarding the Pacific Alliance and its huge potential. I think that goes way beyond economic and commercial integration. I think it could be a very interesting shift of power in the region, and we certainly believe that we, the citizens, should make it clear that we believe it should be space not only, as I said, for commercial economic integration, but also cultural and institutional strengthening. So, as I said, you know, 3 days ago, there was a month from the incident at the Congress. You know, I have to confess you all that for me the hardest time was going back home and facing my child, my daughter. And as I feared, her reaction was bursting in tears when she saw me. And as I saw her, I was seeing, you know, new generations of Venezuela that are growing up in a country under violence, confrontation, and moral degradation. And those days where she took really good care of me was an opportunity to see and feel closely how these generations are also are being brought up with a totally different conscious of citizenship in terms of rights and duties. And only 4 days after the surgery, I had to go to Colombia, actually. And when I was leaving, she told me, okay, you have to behave, take your pills and so on, no son. But she said something. She said, look, Mom, today I do not regret that you were there at the National Assembly. I understand what it means. And, you know, we all take our share of pain and struggle and responsibility in these hours. So that was for me the proof that, you know, there are certain strikes in life that turn out making you even stronger. And that's how I feel regarding the fight for democracy in Venezuela today. We're stronger as a unity, supporting Enrique Capriles and having clear the responsibility that we all have as a generation. I think we're much stronger regarding the international community and actors, now realizing who is the true majority and how we're willing to fight. And but most importantly, I think in a personal level, we have proved ourselves what we're willing and able to do when we have to defend values. And that's the kind of struggle that we're going through. And that's why I'm totally convinced that this epical and ethical fight will be won by your generation. Thank you very much.
Wow, that great remarks. Had to take a moment there. It was very inspiring. But on to the questions. I'm just going to throw out one question first. I want you to talk a little bit about these efforts of parliamentary diplomacy. It's obvious that something different is happening right now in Venezuela. You highlighted the numbers. You mentioned that there's a critical mass of supporters, of people that are outraged regarding the events of the last couple months. I want to know a little bit more about these efforts at parliamentary diplomacy. It's obvious that if something new is happening in Venezuela, that will be complemented by more countries in the region taking a more explicit stance on what's happening there. In particular, I'd like to know what your views are on Brazil. I know you just were in Chile and in other countries, but I think it would be very helpful to us and to the folks watching and listening how you see that going forward. And you just need to...
Just go. Okay. Well, as I said at the beginning, I believe that the international dimension is very important because, as I say, it's a source of legitimacy. And this regime has been very efficient in terms of blackmailing governments throughout the region. You know, I will simplify this. I'd say there are at least three groups. There are those that are economically totally dependent on Venezuela today because of oil or oil dollars and so on. Second group that share the model and actually promote the same kind of control in their own countries. But third, you know, there are democratic countries that have decided to totally ignore what's going on in Venezuela for many reasons. Some could be economic reasons, other could be geopolitical reasons. So we found that, you know, through parliaments, where this control has not been put in place, we have a way in which to address a whole society. Parliaments and interparliamentary relations have the legitimacy of, you know, me and my colleagues represent the people. And it has been wonderful to see members of a parliament that are part of the same political party or the coalition. And you will see President Piñera this afternoon and probably ask him why or how he felt when the Senate last week, we were in Santiago, actually passed a resolution. Only two senators did not voted for it, in which they urge President Piñera to make to have the UNISUR committed decisions, resolution being respected. This has been happening in other congresses as well. Regarding Brazil, I will know how Brazil has been very efficient in limiting the influence of other countries in South America, such as Mexico, the U.S., Canada, and even Spain. And some thought that Brazil would be a very responsible leader of the whole region, but unfortunately the results we've seen is not precisely a coherent and strong and valiant position. For us Venezuelans, it's you know, it's tremendously sad, because for decades our governments had been, you know, preeminent in terms of defending democracy in the region, both in Central America and fighting dictatorships in the South. And now we see even some of these actual people who lived in Venezuela, that receive asylum in Venezuela, are in those governments and have not said one word regarding the destruction of institutions in our country. And that, you know, Brazil, of course, is a very complex situation. So I believe, and I insist, that the alliance, the Pacific Alliance, will probably not only get new opportunities in terms of new voices together with a stronger capacity of making an equilibrium, but prove Brazil that it better has have a different behavior in terms of being coherent in terms of what they do inside and they promote it abroad if they want to maintain the degree of leadership.
We'll take some questions now.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, sure. Hi, good morning. I'm Luis Alonso with the AP. And I would like to ask about the international agenda you just described. I would like to ask you about your visit here in Washington. If you could please elaborate how many days you're going to be here, whether you, or not you plan to meet or have this briefing with members of the U.S. administration or members of Congress here. And how do you see, what are the expectations of the U.S. position in this scenario you described? And if I could throw a second one, if you could please describe the two or three most probable scenarios. You mentioned there are several, but I would like to hear the two or three, and your opinion are the most probable. Thank you.
National agenda. I'm just coming from Mexico, and I'm on my way back. I'll stay in Colombia, so it's been quite busy. Fundamentally, we're talking with Congress and with members, in this case, bipartisan from both chambers, and that's what we are concentrating here. And, of course, some contacts with the media and so on, because public opinion is important, and we have a huge demand of information of what's happening in Venezuela. Regarding the scenarios, you know, Luis, it's from one stream to the other. Unfortunately, as I say, anything could happen, from a social upheaval that, you know, nobody knows what could turn out. It's profoundly dangerous in a country that even officials have accepted that there are over 8 million illegal arms in the streets. So, you know, that's something that is very, very dangerous, certainly. Denounces of rumors of a coup d'etat or a self-coup is something that you heard. Well, Mario Silva gave his own version of that possibility and who would be behind it. And but of course, there could be a scenario of appeasement and having an entrenched regime in which, you know, slice by slice, a society could be dominated. Certainly, all of these would mean a huge instability for Venezuela and for the region, and of course, a potential of violence, which we certainly do not want. So, as I say, there are, you know, Hugo Chavez was, you know, a personalized, obsessively personalized system controlled by him. Without him, there is a very complex group of different interests that it's very hard to say, because I think they're shifting. But what is evident is the degree of confrontation that is being clearer and clearer every day.
You need your microphone. Yeah. And this is your last follow-up.
No. If you could please leave that out. What do you expect of Washington? How do you see Washington playing?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, first, I would say the Congress. We would like to see the U.S. Congress bringing up their voices for institutions, for the democratic process, as we've seen other Congresses throughout the region doing. Second, we believe that the U.S. played an important role in terms of the Inter-American system recently, which was under attack. We believe the OAS is facing a challenge that it's probably huge, unique, and every country that wants the system to be maintained and prevail should see this as a life-threatening opportunity for the system. So we expect that the U.S. As a society and Congress also brings this up. And certainly, you know, the fact that the U.S., and this is something public, said that, you know, the only way they act or the main way they relate to South America or Latin America through Brazil, I think should be revisited.
Okay, so right back here.
Sure. Hi. I'm Cesar Cadevilla. I'm a fellow Venezuelan. And also a member of two grassroots organizations in the area, Venmundo and Vote in Washington. My question to Congresswoman Machado is, what's your opinion about the posture that Organization of American States Secretary Insulza took this past week when he said that he have nothing to say in the meetings of AOS if no member touches the subject regarding Venezuela? What's your opinion about that? Thank you.
I actually said what I thought. No, I'm just kidding. Well, first of all, I think how to say it? We feel terribly insulted because he actually said there is not the environment at the OAS to address this issue. So what I said is, well, first, you know, what is the environment of violence and repression that must arrive in Venezuela so that the U.S. realizes that they should act? That was my first reaction. Second, I mean, that's a horrible excuse, since we all know that Article 19 and 20 at the chamber gives the Secretary General the possibility of himself starting this discussion. And third, that is absolutely not true. I believe that there are countries that would be willing to move forward, and leadership is something that OAS certainly lacks at this point.
Up here in front.
Hi, my name is Jose De Bastos. I'm a journalist from Venezuela and a member of your constituency in the National Assembly. My question is, the electoral body in Venezuela called for local elections in December. What do you think is the message to give the people to participate in those elections, even though we are protesting this last result? I mean, calling a fraud or the cheatings that were in this last election, but how do you ask the people to vote in only 6 months? Thank you.
That's a very good question, Jose. I would say we have to start by realizing that there was a totally different strategy for the Democratic forces regarding the April 14 elections from the October 7th election. There was a totally different strategy. And one of its main elements of change was the fact that we had to speak the truth regarding the electoral process. We cannot underestimate how people feel and know the conditions under which we vote, because we are the ones who suffer them. Those that voted for Maduro with fear against their will last October 14, and you can imagine how many they were. Those that were, you know, looked in their houses and brought to the polling stations, those that were accompanied to the voting station, and you've seen many, I believe, different videos that are on YouTube and social networks and so on, know how bad the process is, how perverse the process is. So, you know, not saying anything because people would be scared is falling into the blackmail this government has used, not only inside, but for the whole international community as well. And the results are there. When you speak with the truth, when you are able to create this spirit of fight, of struggle, the results are different. People look up and follow leadership, leadership that is willing to risk and also is calling for big sacrifices. So regarding this new election, you have to put it into context, why it is important, why we need to fight for it, why we go with this same spirit of fight, but that doesn't mean that we're going to turn the page on what happened April 14th. I mean, it is an existential dimension of fight because it's a fight for the truth. And we got a mandate from the majority of Venezuelan citizens, and we have to defend it. So it is. We have to put it into that context, and I believe that if it's done with that, you know, spoken with truth, the results will be such as we just had in April. A massive turnout.
I'm just going to move it around. I'm going to get back to you, but I want to go on this side over here of the crowd. This late woman here. Sure.
Okay. Hi. Good morning. My name is Fabiana Pereira, and I'm from the George Washington University. I have two separate questions. First question, you spoke about the problems with institutions and really focused on the legislative branch. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the problems with the Tribunal Supremo de Justicia.
Fabiana, no, I didn't understand. If I could speak about?
About the problems with the judicial branch. You spoke about institutional problems and then really talked a lot about the legislative branch. If you could speak a little bit about the judicial branch. And my second not related question is, as a Venezuelan American, what do you think I can do to help?
Right. I was waiting for that question. Desperately. Well, regarding the judicial branch, I mean, I could give you many metrics that prove the degree of submission that the branch has. And I would not only say to the executive branch, but to the Cuban regime. And that's why I say we do not go with being naive to this institution when we had submitted two lawsuits. This last week, I'm sure you are all aware, they ruled against our process to recuse. That's a technical term used here: recuse of two members of the electoral branch, the court. The reasons, because the president of the court, the electoral court, was actually an employee of Nicolás Maduro when he was at the Secretary of State. He was Secretary of State. And the vice president, because he's related to the Secretary of Interior, and both of them were members of the PSUV, the party. They denied this process to recuse them, arguing that they had
resigned.
They had resigned the party just before taking charge of their places. And so, having said that, at the end, it's from in terms of fighting these regimes is always a decision of political cost. What is most costly for them? And that's why we need to increase the political cost, and that's the reason why we are creating conscious inside, organizing, denouncing, protesting, and at the same time doing the same internationally. The cost of an even more unstable and more violent Venezuela has a huge impact in the whole region. It is not a process that is, it's been proved that it's a process that cannot be contained because it has the view behind is expanding its control in the region. And because of the nature of the groups and the businesses that they are related to. In terms of what can be done, I know you had a great event yesterday, and I think those are the kinds of activities that should be maintained throughout the world. Nevertheless, we're talking about a huge diaspora of over 1 million Venezuelans throughout the world, and it's not only in quantity, but the quality. The people that have left Venezuela, people that have done so against their will, most of them, but that either dream to come back, which I hope they do because we will need them soon, but you know, have ties, information, and opportunities. And we're working hard in this new approach in terms of the international agenda to jointly identify actions that increase that international cost for not acting. And well, we can go through a whole list. But the thing I would say is all of you guys that want to be in touch with us, you don't leave this room, please, without giving us your emails and contact information.
In the middle here.
Yes, Duke Banks. I'm a concerned Venezuelan American. And in terms of the international effort for Maria Corina, the Cuban angle, in many ways you could argue that Venezuela is actually a Cuban colony, given, you know, how the Cubans have filtrated, you know, a lot of the institutions. And whether or not as part of the international message with all the parliaments and the other countries in the region, including the OAS, how a country can take over and be so involved in the internal affairs of another country, and how come that isn't raising, you know, some red flags, and whether or not that ought to be put on the, you know, on the list of, you know, for discussion.
That's a really important point. I'm glad you brought it. First, you know, 2 days ago in Mexico, I had the opportunity to meet with all the members of the international external, I would say the Committee for International Relations, External Relations, and I was really glad because members from even the PRD and PT showed up, and the PRI, of course, and PAN and so on. And I asked them, look, how would you feel if all your identification functions were under the control of another regime, an external, not, you know, any regime, any other country? How would you feel if registries, notarias, were controlled with all information regarding mercantile transactions by a different members from a different state? How would you feel if your officials in the army, in the armed forces, would receive actual orders from generals from another army? And this is absolutely true. I mean, myself, last year, twice submitted demands for investigation at the Comisión de Defense, the Defense Committee at the National Assembly, with information that I verified, which I got actually from members, institutional members of the armed forces. Information about the GRUCE, el Grupo de Cooperación y Enlace, which is a group formed by generals and almirants of the Cuban forces that take decisions regarding even buying military arms in Venezuela. So how would a country feel having your sovereignty, national sovereignty, delivered to another country, and even financing it. Because as you see, as you all know, there's an estimate between 7,000 or 12,000 billion and or 7 to 12 billion dollars a year given to the Cubans. But I would say that this is something that it's getting even, you know, clear with the mistakes done by the own government, and as we've seen this week regarding the reaction of first Diosdado Cabello, then Juan, and then Maduro, because of the meeting Enrique Capriles had with Juan Manuel Santos, it makes it evident. I mean, it is evident that the Cubans are behind the Venezuelan participation in these talks. They control it, and actually they do not care for the peace process in Colombia. They try to blackmail, they still do. Nicolás Maduro went yesterday to Nicaragua. And of course, this, instead of having reactions of fear now, I believe, it is, how do you say, gastado, worn off in terms of the amount of blackmail that they can maintain, both the ALBA, Petrocaribe, Venezuela, and so on.
That's great. More questions? I think you had a question, ma'am. Did you have a question? Your hands. Here in the middle. Yeah.
Hi, Maria Carolina. It's amazing and really, I'm sorry, I'm Ninoska Marcano. I'm a freelance journalist, and I'm a Venezuelan American as well. I wanted to know, this seems like a monumental task to actually get the word out and have more countries in the region come and join Venezuela's cause at this point, right? And I wanted to know, I was very disturbed by the fact that you were assaulted in Congress. And I wanted to know if you have had any international women's group that have come forward and condemned the assault. Because I think that if you could comment on perhaps making some sort of connection between this assault to you and the assault to Venezuelan women as a whole, and perhaps retaking a bit of the idea that violence is something that we all share in common besides that. And if you can comment on whether people have been convinced that this is something that they should take as a personal cause, meaning as a woman, and if that would be the first step prior to talking about politics.
That as I say, also said before, it's a great point, Ninoska. I've been moved by the reaction we've seen and felt, all of my colleagues, and in my case, especially the reaction by women. And since that day, I cannot count the number of messages and calls and letters that I've received worldwide. People that I don't know, women that are member of parliaments in Europe and Asia that wrote to us, and especially what has been more moving for me is that reaction I get from women in the street is, it is new, not you that were hurt, it's all women. You know, we, the women, were actually hurt when they hurt you. And I do believe we need to make that connection about the degree of damage that's been done to Venezuelan families and what women are willing to do at this point in terms to defend them and as well as the country. So it hasn't been, to answer your question, yet an official group, but there have been so many messages and words of support that I believe that certainly there is the possibility to turn it into a whole cause, not led by me. I would say I would be only part of it.
I'm going to interject. I have one question for you. What's it like to do your job? What's it like to go to the assembly after that kind of episode happens? I mean, we talk about some of the issues that happen in the U.S. right now, that there are difficulties between the parties, that folks don't want to meet and talk and try to hammer out solutions to the problems that we have in this country. But luckily, we haven't had things get to be the way that they were or are in Venezuela. Can you talk a little bit about what's it like to go back to the chamber? I mean, you're a small minority, and you're faced with, and I'm saying in the assembly, and you're faced with this sort of intimidation. Can anything get done legislatively? I'm assuming not. I mean, can you go into some detail about what it's like to be in the assembly now? And
well, actually, violence is not only physical, and it's important to remember that we are actually a minority because we won the assembly legislative elections in 2010. Of course, they knew that was going to happen. They changed the rules, so on. So we have roughly 40% of the seats. Violence has been increasing since then. I mean, the fact that before the 13 the April 30 events, when we went to Congress, you face that just getting in is a challenge. I mean, you have groups that are very violent surrounding Congress. Some of my colleagues have been hurt in the past. I have to say that I had a lot of support before by the National Guard in terms of getting me out. Several times that I have interactions in Congress with different people, some of them you've seen, that President Chavez and others, I had to have actually the National Guard take me out by, you know, a door that because there were people outside waiting for us. In the inside, we also see that. I mean, the places where public usually sat before, now sometimes not, our parliamentary assistants are not even allowed to go today. And what they bring are groups that are very violent. They insult us. They have been even throwing things to us while we're sitting in your place at Congress. Of course, this reached a stage we never imagined when the session 2 days after the election, April 16, actually I spoke. Mine was the last right to speak, and I presume Teniente Cabello didn't like what I said, because after that he said, well, from now on, nobody, no member of the parliament who first speaks out accepting total legitimacy will be able to talk. That's next session was, as I said, and I probably saw on April 30, I was the one that it was my turn to coordinate the whole session. You know, we are five fractions, five groups in the opposition, and we shift. And that day it was my responsibility to have to coordinate the whole unity. So I had the opportunity to interact for over 45 minutes with a president of the National Assembly, making it clear that it was, you know, in both interest to move along and that he had to respect the Constitution in terms of we, the MPs, having absolutely total right to speak out whatever we believe is the true or conscious states. He was clear to me at that time that either we accepted his demand or we wouldn't speak. So, and they thought that, you know, being very hard and clear in these terms and having proved they could be violent first, we would concede. So that was when violence started. And believe me, it was much worse than what you saw. When we arrived there, all of the doors of the hall, the session hall, were locked with chains, and just only one door was opened. The internet signal was cut. It was very hard to send messages, even by SMS. There were like metal detectors in the door. First time I saw that. Obviously, it only worked for one side of the parliament. And there were armed people, security armed people inside a hall, which clearly violates or the rules and the laws. So we knew that something strange was happening. We had to wait for 3 hours until the session started, and well, the rest is history. What I say is that, you know, we had some of our alternate MPs sitting up, taping the process, and when everything was happening, members of the security of Señor Cabello went up and actually by force got the video cameras and cellular phones for them. So what I'm saying is that we would have had proof of the degree of violence that actually took place that is much worse than went out. Going back, let me tell you something. I never felt so accompanied in my entire life. The first time I stepped in the National Assembly after that day, I felt very deep inside that every single Venezuelan citizen that is fighting our cause was with us, and we felt stronger as a group than ever.
Great. Right here in the front.
Yes,
Mike. No, you need a microphone, sir. Hold on 1 second. Yeah. And if you could identify yourself, too. Thanks.
Boris Saavedra from National Defense University.
Okay.
My question is the way ahead. In this coming month in Venezuela, you know perfect better than all of us the level of politicization of the armed forces. How you see the behavior of the armed forces in this very political conflict, what role they will play, how you see them, and how you see the participation in the political conflict, and how you will see to resolve and maintain the armed forces away from politics.
Well, it is evident that Hugo Chavez's objective was to demoralize the armed forces and destroy the professional and moral unity. And the way the militias were created, the way they eliminated all kind of merit in terms of ascensos and decision regarding the technical officers have created a strong division inside. We all know that there are many groups, some of them at very high positions linked to illegal activities. And that is something that is well designed in order to also blackmail and control the armed forces. Nevertheless, I it's obvious that there is a very important institutional sector. The reaction to Mario Silva's tapes regarding the use of arms, being given arms to and this confession has created enormous conflict inside. I believe it's hard to assess. Nonetheless, we certainly expect the armed forces to follow the route we're working on, which is an institutional one with the pressure of the people, probably in incremental steps in the streets, as I say, with nonviolence form of protest, but having the armed force. Now they have very clear what's the majority and the popular sovereignty, what it means, and that it of course it is their duty to protect and respect it. It won't be an easy process once this transition is started to reinstitutionalize the whole corp, because I believe that the main damage, it's not in their technical capacity, which is huge, or their training, which is enormous and will know that, but it's basic a moral damage that should be corrected.
I'm going to go in the back, the gentleman with the green tie. I thought I was, yeah. Is the microphone on? You don't have a tie on, but it's all right.
Well, two other guys and me are from Cuba. Okay. We are here visiting. We are Cuban Democrats. Okay, we are here visiting, and this is an opportunity to tell you that we support your fight for democracy in Venezuela. But my question is simple. Why Venezuelan opposition has not established relations with Cuban opposition in order to foster our relation and to strengthen the fight in different dimensions of democracy in both countries? And I think you have missed the opportunity to do that, to put a missile behind the Cuban government in order to fight for your own democracy. And that's my question.
¿Lo quiere hacer en español también?
Okay. Bueno, dos otras dos personas y yo estamos aquí de visita. Somos activistas pro-democráticos en Cuba. Estamos de visita en algunos lugares de los Estados Unidos. Y esta es una oportunidad excepcional de expresarle nuestro apoyo por su lucha pro-democrática en Venezuela. Mi pregunta es, ¿por qué la oposición venezolana no ha establecido primero una relación, luego fortalecido ese vínculo y esa relación con la oposición democrática en Cuba? Dado el hecho de que los dos países están, de alguna manera, fatalmente unidos, ¿no? Por lo menos por ahora. Y yo creo que, y extrañamos la posibilidad de que la oposición venezolana y la oposición cubana tengan una relación estrecha, porque eso habría significado poner un misil detrás de la retaguardia del gobierno cubano a la hora de debilitarle su manejo del asunto venezolano, que es evidente y claro. Y quisiera un comentario suyo. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
No hay que tomar todo literalmente, ¿no? Para aquellos miembros de la embajada que están aquí y nos acompañan hoy, por favor, o sea, hay ciertas cosas, ¿verdad? Anyway, you're right, not only with the democratic forces in Cuba. We have not done that with democratic forces and voices throughout the world. And that's part of what we're trying to do now. We understand that there are people that do care for what's happening in Venezuela, throughout Latin America, throughout the world, and we need to tighten our relations and understand that, as I said before, it's not only what's at stake, it's not the democracy in Venezuela, it's the stability of the region, it's the democracy of the whole region. And there are countries that are going through really hard processes, such as ours, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Bolivia, certainly. And I believe that we, since we have common challenges, we should have common forts. And thank you very much for your words, and it's a mutual support.
Right up here, the gentleman with the tie.
It was a blue tie, though. I'm Per Kurovsky from Petropolitan, an NGO in Venezuela, fights for oil revenue sharing. I realize Maria Corina is not a lawyer, but an engineer. But if she was to advise a bank about the contracting capability of debt, contracting new debt of the current Venezuelan government, what would she be telling that bank?
Well, I certainly believe that Venezuela is going to be a really good business opportunity. And, well, as I say, I'm not a lawyer nor a businesswoman anymore. So you will decide what is the best moment to do your investments. Nonetheless, we know, you know, I mean, independent groups that are measuring what the behavior of Venezuelan institutions, such as the IMEDE this week, place Venezuela in the last place out of 60 countries that doing business index that it's under fire right now at the World Bank also proves the degree of violations that that take place in your country today. So, but I know that you are addressing the government-to-government deals, and I believe that is something that the capacity of enforcing those deals of this government is practically null at this point. And as I said before, I believe one of the reasons why you see this change in Latin America regarding the way we're received is because the perception that there will be a government change has increased significantly. So, as we said before, those contracts that are convenient for both parts or that comply with our constitution could certainly be maintained, but otherwise they will certainly be reviewed.
Up front here.
Hola, hi. Maria Corina, first I just want to thank you because as a Venezuelan, we deeply admire what you're doing for our country. Like you have, I mean, you have idea, but yeah. Anyhow, my question is more of a theoretical question, an ideological question. You're talking about a government that is a neo-dictatorship, that's how you call it, and I agree. And a government that has already used violence, institutions that do not work, or that are very, very corrupted. And yet you have your democratic values up, and so do the other members of the opposition. But in this scenario that is a dictatorship, for how long can you keep their democratic values up? And for how long can you fight a dictatorship with democratic tools? So this is an ideological question.
¿Cuál es tu nombre? Marcela. That is a great question. And I would say, and I have always said, that the neo-dictatorship is worse than a classical dictatorship. It's tougher to confront and fight because precisely it disguises itself under some electoral forms, such democratic forms, such as elections. And you know, as these new forms of authoritarian regime have emerged in a world where it is politically incorrect to obviously be authoritarian, well, new forms of struggle have to emerge as well. And that's why it's been so hard for Venezuelans. That's why people have been so hard on us, saying that we have contradictions, that we have different positions, but it's the only possible way to learn, because you are fighting a regime that is not democratic, but it uses some democratic forces or tools. So we found that you have to do both things. You have to have resistencia in terms and what it means of create a resistencia, but also go through and work through those democratic or traditional democratic ways to contest that they still use. How long? As long as it takes, and it's going to take, how to say, menos largo, less longer than many believe. Our main challenge, Marcela, will be to construct, to build a society, and I'm not referring to the economical dimension. I think there is this desire to produce and to create this productive energy that's been accumulated through these years, that it's there. And we will see it explode, and we will see huge opportunities and people coming back, because we will need a lot of things being done and well done. My biggest concern is how we rebuild this social cohesion and trust. And that will take a leadership style based on values, based on example that we've not seen for generations. And that's what we're working on and forming on, and that's why we will need you in part of that team too.
Sir, with glasses here in the back.
Good morning, Maria Corina. Good morning. My name is Roberto Nasser. My question to you is, the day that you do become president of Venezuela, what is the first thing you are going to want to do?
Go to the next question. Back again, trust. I think that Enrique Capriles' biggest asset is the fact that he has shown that he will be the president of all Venezuelans, which doesn't mean impunity, because we will not have peace without justice. This is something that someone said a while ago, as a pope, actually. as we cannot have peace without freedom, because that would be slavery. I think that the main message to create trust is that we will fight for justice, and we will be able to pardon. We need to pardon. And we need to bring back a whole society together that has been divided under every single possible aspect: racial, generational, economical, social, religious. So I think at the end it has to do with trust. And in order to be trusted, you have to trust first. And I have a huge, profound trust in us Venezuelans and our generation.
One more question. Right up here, woman with the orange blouse. Yeah.
Maria Corina, Marian Caballero, a former staffer of Enrique Capriles in the campaign for October 7th, a master's in public policy at the Kennedy School. I just didn't want to let you go without addressing the issue of the change of ownership from Globovisión and what that's going to mean for the Venezuelan opposition. I'm particularly interested whether there has been a consideration of the change of strategy that you may have when addressing the people. How are you going to get in touch with people without the media? Of course, there's groundwork that can be done, but what is it going to mean if there's not even a camera to show what it is that Enrique might be doing or that the other opposition candidates might be doing for even the regional elections?
Of course, Marianne, that's a huge point. And I don't want to underestimate it. I understand that, locally, I've seen my colleagues and, saying, well, don't worry, we have the social media. Romulo Betancourt didn't have TV stations and so on. I've heard things such as that. But let's be clear. The fact is that today we've lost the possibility of having the actual the capacity to convocar, to call, to join in real time in terms, and that's basically what TV gives you. Twitter and so it's very different in terms of its actual capacity to call people. For if we decide to have protest, we have reunions, even caceroliar. So it creates a huge challenge. And many of us thought that it was going to be a progressive process in terms of changing the editorial line or limiting access to Capriles and other. And it has been much faster and further than expected. I'm sure you are all aware, the government called the other two big TV stations for personal meetings. They were closed-door meetings. I think we don't need to have a presence there to imagine it's their content. It proves one thing. This regime is willing to do anything in order to stay in power and block the truth for being delivered and known. Second, they are very scared because they know they've lost their legitimacy. They know, they've known they're a minority for a long time, but now they know that we all know. And there are many different weaknesses that are showing, such as the degree of corruption, the struggle for power, the ties with other groups and businesses, but mostly the voices of citizens saying enough, and it's time to fight firmly for what we believe. Having said that, this will only require stronger, bigger, further organization. And in that area, all of you that live abroad are a huge, huge opportunity and support. I will end up saying that when I was going to Santiago last week, it was going to Peru, to Lima. We were in the plane, and there were several Venezuelans who live in Peru, and there was this young girl, such as you, that came up to me, and you know, she called me and said, look, I've heard many times that here you feel that when one Venezuelan leaves a country, we've lost a fighter. That is totally incorrect. It's quite the opposite. What we've gained is a strong voice, firmly committed outside to speak out for us, and that it's, you know, desiring desperately that we will triumph in order to come back. So that's what we are all here. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, and I don't think I need to say anything. This has been an impressive session. I want to thank you again for coming, for choosing us. You're doing some incredible work. More power to you. We support you. And thank you all for coming. And I hope I see you today at 3 o'clock when President Piñera comes.